Happy Christmas from Near FM.
Welcome to our Curtain of Christmas special on Air FM. We have a big audience in tonight, a big house. You hear all the clapping. There's 250 people crowded in here, and it's wonderful. A warm welcome to all those listening to us on 90.3 FM and online on www.near.ie/livestream. My name is Declan Cahill, and I, along with the Near Drama Company and friends, will be presenting this live programme. Now, we have a full house here in Studio 2, all raring to go. So, and we have George Mulcahy and the lovely Deborah Gaffney, she'll kill me for saying that, looking after us in the control room. Now, we have a lot to cover, so let's go straight into our first item. And this is a beautiful, beautiful story that we do every year, and it's called 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, written by Clement Clark Moore, and it's going to be read now and performed by Niamh Murphy.
'Twas the night before Christmas, when all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care, in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there. The children were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads. And Mama in her kerchief, and I in my cap, had just settled our brains for a long winter's nap. When out on the lawn there arose such a clatter, I sprang from the bed to see what was the matter. Away to the window I flew like a flash, tore open the shutters and threw up the sash. The moon on the breast of the new fallen snow gave the lustre of midday to objects below. When, what to my wondering eyes should appear but a miniature sleigh and 8 tiny reindeer, with a little old driver, so lively and quick, I knew in a moment it must be St. Nick. More rapid than eagles, his coursers they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by name.
Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen, on Comet, on Cupid, on Donder and Blitzen, to the top of the porch, to the top of the wall, now dash away, dash away, dash away all.
As dry leaves before the wild hurricane fly, when they meet with an obstacle, mount to the sky. So up to the housetop the coursers they flew, with a sleigh full of toys, and St. Nicholas too. And then in a twinkling I heard on the roof the prancing and pawing of each little hoof. As I drew in my head and was turning around, down the chimney St. Nicholas came with a bound. He was dressed all in fur from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. A bundle of toys was flung on his back, and he'd looked like a peddler just opening his pack. His eyes, how they twinkled! His dimples, how merry! His cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry. His droll little mouth was drawn up like a bow, and the beard of his chin was as white as the snow. The stump of a pipe he held tight in his teeth, and the smoke it encircled his head like a wreath. He had a broad smile and a little round belly that shook when he laughed like a bowl full of jelly. He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf, and I laughed when I saw him in spite of myself. A wink in his eye and a twist of his head soon gave me to know I had nothing to dread. He spoke not a word, but went straight to his work, and filled all the stockings, and then turned with a jerk. and laying his finger aside of his nose, and giving a nod, up the chimney he rose. He sprung to his sleigh, to his team gave a whistle, and away they all flew like the down of a thistle. But I heard him exclaim as he drove out of sight, "Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night."
Well done, Dave. That was lovely, wasn't it? It's great to see a programme starting like that. Now we're going to go into another piece. Before we do that, I want to tell you, if you want to contact the programme, you can text us here directly into the studio on 087 69 44 500. That's 087 69 44 500. If you want to telephone to give out to us or make a suggestion to go home or whatever, it's a Dublin number, 867 1190. 867 1190. Now I understand there's people listening in from the Republic of Cork, from the Kingdom of Kerry, and even from South Sudan. Would you believe that? Yeah.
No.
So, if anybody wants to contact, they can simply do that. Now, our next item is the Christmas Carol, but this is an adaptation of the Dickens story by Gabby Goldsack, and it's going to be narrated by Peter Pryor, and the story will be told by members of the drama group. So, A Christmas Carol.
One Christmas Eve in old London town, Ebenezer Scrooge looked out with a frown.
"Merry Christmas, Uncle,"
called his cheery nephew.
"Come and join in our Christmas dinner, won't you?"
"Bah, humbug,"
growled Scrooge.
"A Christmas day? What's merry about it? Now just go away."
Poor Cratchit, his clerk, who worked hard each day, asked Scrooge,
"Is tomorrow a holiday?"
"I suppose you want me to pay you as well,"
grumbled Scrooge, who was mean, as I'm sure you can tell. Scrooge hated Christmas because he was greedy. He felt no pity for the poor and the needy. Later that evening, when Scrooge was alone, he heard rattling chains and a ghostly moan. Then Scrooge saw poor Marley, who in happier days was Scrooge's partner with his same selfish ways.
"Scrooge!"
wailed the ghost.
"I've come to warn thee, mend your mean ways, or you'll end up like me. Deep in the night before Christmas Day, three spirits will come to show you the way."
With that, Marley's ghost then started to fade, leaving Ebenezer Scrooge alone and afraid. Scrooge was dismayed as he crept into bed, but he drifted to sleep despite his great dread. As the clock struck one on that freezing night, Ebenezer Scrooge awoke with a fright. And as he blinked his eyes in the gloom, an unearthly spirit appeared in the room.
"Follow me,"
it said as Scrooge looked aghast.
"I am the ghost of Christmas past."
The ghost took Scrooge back to Christmases of old, when Scrooge was warm-hearted, not sad and cold. They saw Fan, his sister, and Fezziwig, his boss.
"I was happy,"
gasped Scrooge.
"Not lonely and cross."
And as Scrooge was shown each old Christmas day, he cried,
"I can't bear it! Take me away!"
In the blink of an eye, Scrooge returned to his bed and was met by a jolly spirit who said,
"I am the good ghost of Christmas present. Follow me now to see something pleasant."
In a flash, they were in Bob Cratchit's place, which looked very festive, despite the cramped space. Scrooge watched the Cratchits sit down to eat their small Christmas dinner, as if a great treat.
"God bless us, everyone,"
Tiny Tim cried, as his family blessed him, smiling with pride.
"Tiny Tim,"
said the spirit,
"will always be lame, but he is still cheerful, despite his great pain."
As the spirit departed, another took shape, a horrible creature in a hood and a cape. It spoke not a word and seemed to be dumb. It was the ghost of Christmas yet to come. At the graveyard it showed Scrooge what lay ahead, misery and sorrow, for Tiny Tim was dead. Then Scrooge saw his own grave, unloved and unkept, alone in a cemetery where nobody wept. As they wandered the streets, he heard people say, "The old miser's gone, but who cares anyway?" As the ghost disappeared, Scrooge did something strange. He fell down and wept.
"Now I know I must change."
The very next moment Scrooge woke in his bed, he raced to the window, then joyfully said,
I haven't missed Christmas. What wonderful fun. Merry Christmas!
He called out.
To everyone!
Then he stopped a small boy and asked humbly,
Please, take this turkey to the Tratchett family.
Then, handing out gifts, he tramped through the chill to call on his nephew and wish him goodwill. And so began a most wonderful day, full of laughter and joy, feasting and play. Scrooge had been taught, as we hoped he would, not to be mean, but giving and good.
Very good, very good. So there's a lesson for all of us. We've got to be much better than we are. Now, moving on, now we're going to do something a bit more lighthearted now, and this is a little story called I Keep My Snowman in the Freezer, written by Ian Macmillan, and it's going to be read by Maura Walsh.
I keep my snowman in the freezer, just behind the pies. He likes it there. He told me so. You can see it in his eyes. I made him on a cold, cold morning when the snow was fresh and deep. Now he sits in the freezer near the fish that we got cheap. I keep my snowman in the freezer and look at him each day. If I'd left him in the garden, he'd simply have melted away. But now he's like my grandma, living somewhere safe and warm. He's in a frosty, snowy palace on a throne of coldest ice. I keep my snowman in the freezer near a lump of frozen beef, and I've got a treat for him in August. I'm taking him to Tenerife.
Well done. Now, boys and girls, young and old, the next is a story that you all must be very carefully listening and listen to it, because there's a moral to the story. And it is the story called The Boy Who Laughed at Santa Claus, a story written by Ogden Nash, and is going to be performed now by Mary McNamara.
In Baltimore there lived a boy. He wasn't anybody's joy. Although his name was J.B.'s Dawes, his character was full of flaws. In school he never led his classes. He hid old ladies' reading glasses. His mouth was open when he chewed, and elbows to the table glued. He stole the milk of hungry kittens, and walked through doors marked No Admittance. He acted thus because he said there wasn't any Santa Claus. Another trick that tickled J.B.'s was crying boo at little babies. He brushed his teeth, they said in town, sideways instead of up and down. Yet people pardoned every sin and viewed his antics with a grin. Till they were told by J.B. Dawes, there isn't any Santa Claus. Deploring how he did behave, his parents swiftly sought their grave. They hurried through the portals pearly, and J.B.'s, well, he left the funeral early. Like whooping cough from child to child, he spread the rumour wild, yes, wild. Sure as my name is J.B.'s Dawes, there isn't any Santa Claus. Slunk like a weasel of a Martin through nursery and kindergarten, whispering low to every tot, there isn't any, no, there's not. The children wept all Christmas Eve, and J.B.'s chortled up his sleeve. No infant dared hang up his stocking, for fear J.B.'s gave them a mocking. He sprawled on his untidy bed, fresh malice dancing in his head. When presently, with scalp a-tingling, J.B.'s heard a distant jingling. He heard the crunch of sleigh and hoof crisply alighting on the roof. What good to rise and bar the door? A shower of soot was on the floor. What was beheld by J.B.'s Dawes? The fireplace full of Santa Claus. Then J.B.'s fell upon his knees with cries of don't and pretty please. He howled, I don't know where you read it, but anyhow I never said it. J.B.'s, replied the angry saint. It isn't I, it's you that ain't. Although there is a Santa Claus, there isn't any J.B.'s Dawes, said J.B.'s then with impudent vim. Oh, yes, there is, and I am him. Your magic doesn't scare me, it doesn't. And suddenly he found he wasn't. From grimy feet to grimy locks, J.B.'s became a jack-in-the-box, an ugly toy with springs unsprung, forever sticking out his tongue. The neighbours heard his mournful squeal. They searched for him, but not with zeal. No trace was found of J.B. Dawes, which led to thunderous applause, and people drank a loving cup and went and hung their stockings up. All you who sneer at Santa Claus, beware the faith of J.B. Dawes, the saucy boy who mocked the saint. Donner and Blitzen licked off his paint.
So let that be a lesson to, isn't that dreadful? Anybody who doesn't believe in Santa Claus, I just do not believe it. Oh, dreadful. Now, you're listening to Curtain Up, is a Christmas special, and you can contact us by texting us here 087-6944-500. Now, we're going to go to a song. And this is a song which is, we now have it on a CD, very grand. And it's called The Christmas Shoes and it's going to be sung by Enya Murphy.
It was almost Christmas time. There I stood in another line, trying to buy that last gift or two. I'm really in the Christmas mood. Standing right in front of me was a little boy waiting anxiously. Pacing round like little boys do, and in his hands he held a pair of shoes. And his clothes were worn and old, he was dirty from head to toe. And when it came his time to pay, I couldn't believe what I heard him say. Sir, I wanna buy these shoes for my mama, please. It's Christmas Eve and these shoes are just her size. Could you hurry, sir? Daddy says there's not much time. You see, she's been sick for quite a while, and I know these shoes will make her smile, and I want her to look beautiful if Mama meets Jesus tonight. They counted pennies for what seemed like years, then the cashier said, son, there's not enough here. He searched his pockets frantically. Then he turned and he looked at me. He said, Mama, make Christmas good in our house, even those years they just did without. Tell me, sir, what am I supposed to do? Somehow I've gotta buy her these Christmas shoes. So I laid the money down, I just had to help him out. And I'll never forget the look on his face when he said, Mama's gonna look great. Sir, I wanna buy these shoes for my mama, please. It's Christmas Eve and these shoes are just her size. Could you hurry, sir? Daddy says there's not much time. You see, she's been sick for quite a while, and I know these shoes will make her smile, and I want her to look beautiful if Mama meets Jesus tonight. I knew I'd caught a glimpse of heaven's love as he thanked me and ran out. I knew that God had sent that little boy to remind me what Christmas is is all about. Sir, I wanna buy these shoes for my mama, please. It's Christmas Eve and these shoes are just her size. Could you hurry, sir? Daddy says there's not much time. You see, she's been sick for quite a while, and I know these shoes will make her smile, and I want her to look beautiful if Mama meets Jesus tonight. I want her to look beautiful if Mama meets Jesus tonight.
That was The Christmas Shoes, sung by Enya Murphy. If that doesn't get a tear out of a stone, I don't know what will. Now, ladies and gentlemen, when I was researching the programme for tonight, I came across a lot of stories about house repossessions and evictions and so on. And when that was going on, I came across a book called The Big Book of Hope, and it was written some time ago in aid of the Hope Foundation. They do a lot of work in India. But this is a range of Irish writers which contributed to it. And there was a story which really caught my attention, written by Bill Cullen, an extract from A Long Way from Penny Apples. And this extract is about an eviction, and it's entitled Mary Beats Off the Eviction Bowsies.
Eviction! Eviction! The corpo are here for Mrs. Walsh. It's an eviction.
Mary Darcy opened her eyes and sat up listening.
Did I hear eviction?
Rita nodded, just as the roar went up again.
Eviction! Eviction! It's the corpo for Mrs. Walsh.
With that, there was a loud bang of a door hitting the wall and the tramp of hobnailed boots on the stone hall. Mary's face flushed red and she stood up with anger in her eyes.
Give me that poker, Rita. And Liam, you get that sweeping brush and come with me. You girls mind the little ones.
There was a pause as she retied her white apron around her swollen tummy and then took the poker and waved for Liam to follow her.
I don't believe this. It can't be an eviction in this day and age, in this kip of a house.
She opened the door and then leaned back to dip her fingers in the holy water font and blessed herself and sprinkled some water on her son. There were roars and screams coming up the stairs from Mrs. Walsh's room at the back of the hall.
Let's go!
Down the stairs she went, with Liam behind her. The corporation had taken over the tenements years before from the profiteering landlords who'd evicted tenants left, right and centre for not paying their rent. But the corpo had a more charitable outlook, and evictions were now seldom seen. Only one had happened in the last 12 months. That had been at the top end of Summerhill, and the old fellow was moving on anyway. It was still a fearful sight to see the corpo men throw every piece of his belongings out onto the footpath and leave him sitting there in the rain while they boarded up the doors and windows of the room. His brother arrived later that night with a horse and cart. They loaded up his bits and bobs, and off they went, never to be heard of again. When Mary turned the corner of the stairs, she saw three corpo lads in the hall, with Mrs. Walsh's table and chairs already being handed out from man to man. Some children were standing barefoot in the hall crying, and she could hear Mrs. Walsh's voice from the room pleading tearfully.
No, no, don't throw us out. Don't throw us out.
Mary let out a roar.
What's going on here, you bowsies?
And she smashed the poker on the banisters with a loud crash that brought the men to a halt.
Who's in charge here?
Out from the room came a big red-faced man, followed by Mr. Sutton, the rent collector.
I'm in charge here now, missus. Now you just buzz off and mind your own business. This is an official corporation eviction, and you'll be in the clink if you're not careful.
Mary gave the banister another bang with the poker.
Well, aren't you the big brave culchy now, threatening women and children, sneaking in here when our men are out walking to pay our rent? If it's trouble you want, you've come to the right place. And I'm telling you to leave Mrs. Walsh's things alone, or you'll have me to deal with. And as for you, Mr. Sutton, come out from behind that culchy and speak up for yourself. Don't you know Mr. Walsh was in hospital for a few months with the kidney stones, and he's back walking now, and they'll clear after your ears. Don't you all know that? And why are you here with these lachios doing your dirty work?
Mr. Sutton just blinked behind his glasses at the big man did the answering.
Listen, woman, it's none of your business. He's had plenty of warnings, and when any talent falls behind by more than 6 months, it's out. That's the policy, and there's no discussion. Right, me lads, get some of the job. Come on, oh, you move that chair, Paddy. Get the table there, will you? Move on, will you?
Before they could move, Mary smashed the banister again with the poker.
So that's the policy, is it now? Let's throw the sick man and his family out on the street is the policy. Because they owe the corpo a few lousy pounds. Let's get a big, brave culture from Cork with his pals to dump them on the road. Sure, they're well used to this job. Didn't some of you help the English landlords during the famine days? Torn coats and informers you are, who take on only the women and childers. We'll leave the room there empty and put Mrs. Walsh out in the rain. Well, that's the policy we had when the Brits were here. And many's a brave Irishman's blood was spilled to get them out and change that policy. Is that what Michael Collins fought for? Of course, he was a great man from Cork, and he was shot in the back by one of his own. The like of you. Let me tell you this, me bio. The first man that moves a stick of that furniture out of this hall will get my poker over his head.
What a tirade. The big Corkman was kicking the wall, saying,
"Fick you anyway! Fick you! Fick you!"
Mary Darcy stood halfway up the stairs in her white apron, heavily pregnant, waving the poker, her face flushed with anger. Her young son stood beside her, with a sweeping brush headed across his chest. Mary came down the stairs into the hall and took a chair from one of the men without resistance.
"Now, Mr. Sutton, why don't you get these men out of here and let's see how we can clear off Mrs. Walsh's arrears. Sure, I've £2 here in me pocket. Wouldn't that be a better thing to do than having some of them culchies in hospital?"
The big man was livid with temper at the insults that had been heaped on him. He would have killed any man who used such words to him. But he was helpless and frustrated when faced with a pregnant woman. The rent collector broke the tension.
"Well, are you saying, Mrs. Cullen, that we can have the arrears paid?"
"Of course I'm saying the arrears will be paid, Mr. Sutton. Get rid of these bios and we'll sit down on these chairs and work everything out."
"Right then. You go on back to the office, Seamus, and I'll sort this out."
The big man kicked the wall in frustration.
"Be Jesus, I go back to no feckin' office. I go down to Conway's pub and you'll meet us there to pay us for our day's work, so you will."
And down the hall he went, with the sparks flying from his hobnail boots. The other men put down the furniture and trailed out after him.
Bring that stuff in now, Liam. And why don't you put the teapot on, Mrs. Walsh? I'm sure Mr. Sutton could do with a cup of while we talk business."
20 minutes later, Mr. Sutton left, with the promise of 6 shillings a week payment off the arrears, as well as the rent from next week on. Mrs. Walsh didn't know where she'd get the extra money from.
What about the rent?
Don't worry about that, Mrs. Walsh. Sure, if we've won the haggle today, and we can win it again if we need it to be.
Vera and Rita had been watching the commotion from the landing. When Mary arrived back, it was to a steaming mug of tea and a slice of toast ready for her on the table. She smiled at them all and sat down.
"Isn't it a great bunch I have here now? The girls looking after the house and this young fella standing in for his da. You can put this poker back and that brush of yours away now, son."
But as she sipped her tea, she grimaced and said,
"Oh, Liam. Oh, run down and tell Mother Darcy to come up here quickly. Vera, will you put that big pot of water on the stove?"
That evening, Carmel was born in the tenement room. When they trooped back for bed, Mary was sitting up with the new baby and Billy was there beside her. Mother Darcy was having a mug of shell cocoa. She had a proud look on her face and her sleeves were still rolled up.
"Mother Darcy brought the new baby from the chapel in her shopping bag."
That was the story Rita gave. The Dar was back in Brooks Thomas, but only part-time. He got the odd few days' work with his brother Jack in Granby Pork Products. Granby were up in Granby Lane at the back of Dominic Street Church, beside the rear of Walden Ford dealers. At other times, he worked as an usher in the picture houses, the Plaza in Granby Row and the Rotunda Cinema at the Parnell Monument. His military training was great for keeping the queues of children under control, and he was meticulous in his cleanliness for the butchers. But he'd no work coming up to the Christmas, and the markets had a lean spell for Mary, who was still nursing her new baby, Carmel. The rain was seeping in around the tenement windows, and Billy had used up bundles of heralds plugging the cracks to keep the drafts out. One day, his old army pal, Jolly Coleman, had dropped in with 6 army greatcoats.
You have to keep those children of yours warm in bed, Mary. And these are just the job.
The coats went over the thin blankets and were a godsend for the kids.
Oh, snug as a bug in a rug yarn now.
Don't mention bugs, Mary. I spent the last week fighting the clocks and spiders coming in these damp walls. The powder I got down at Confolder's medical hall seems to be working. It's certainly done the job in the old mattresses, because I haven't seen a hopper since I doused them.
Mary was quiet as she rocked the baby's cot.
We'll have to get out of here, Billy, before this bloody place takes another one of our babies. Have you heard anything from the corpo? Mick Mullen put in a word for us, and he told me that with 7 kids now, we should be getting an offer of a place soon.
No, Billy, I haven't seen Mick, but I'll go and find him at Liberty Hall tomorrow. I to see Alfie Bourne next Tuesday.
Mary didn't respond. She just kept rocking the baby's cot.
Jack has promised me some corned beef and pig's feet for Christmas. Ah, it'll make a fine dinner for the kids. They love the trotters.
It was no use. She was away somewhere else. So he just undressed and went to bed. Hours later, he woke. Mary was at the table, darning some of the children's gansies, singing her song in a low voice as she rocked the cot with her foot.
Somewhere over the rainbow, skies are blue, and the dreams that you dare to dream really do come true.
Lovely. That was a presentation of an extract from a book by Cullen called Mary Beats Off the Eviction Bowsies. The parts were played by Michael Sharp as the narrator, Peter Pryor, Carol Dempsey, John O'Connor, Ursula Byrne, and Joe Murphy played the parts. And that was very, very moving. When I read that part first some weeks ago, I was really moved by it. And, you know, it's amazing when you hear about people losing their homes, and now we have the latest situation in Dublin and elsewhere, people trying to get homes. It really hits me very, very hard. And I think that part really shows how little has changed in our country. So I think just let's take a lesson from it. So, ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Curtain Up, a Christmas special, and now we're going to have a live song sung by a young lady called Mia Shallander. And Mia, you're very welcome. Is this your first time on radio?
Yeah.
Well, you're very welcome. It's not the last, I'd say. And Mia now is going to sing a song called When Christmas Comes to Town.
I'm wishing on a star and trying to believe that even though it's far, he'll find me Christmas Eve. I guess that Santa's busy, 'cause he's never come around. I think of him when Christmas comes to town. The best time of the year, when everyone comes home with all this Christmas cheer, it's hard to be alone. Putting up the Christmas tree with friends who come around, it's so much fun when Christmas comes to town. Presents for the children wrapped in red and green, all the things I've heard about but never really seen. No one will be sleeping on the night of Christmas Eve, hoping Santa's on his way. When Santa's sleigh bells ring, I listen all around. The herald angels sing, I never hear a sound. And all the dreams of children once lost will all be found. That's all I want when Christmas comes to town.
Very, very good. That's lovely. Very good. Mia, you said, they say you should never ask a woman her age, but just want to clear we are, Mia. What age are you, Mia?
11.
11. So what class are you in?
Sixth.
So next year, next September into first year.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you selected your school yet?
Yeah.
Yeah. Where are you going to go to?
Manor House,
a lovely school. Very good. Well done, Mia. That was absolutely gorgeous. Well done. Aww. And I wish you very well. Right, ladies and gentlemen, that's you can see the clapping there for with her huge cast there. You might hear some noises because it's like musical chairs. We have six mics, so we're trying to manage all the different people. Now, this year is a great year for anniversaries, of course, our own 1916 commemorating the rebellion. And then we had the 1916 of one of the dreadful battles and war during this First World War. And then I want to finish off with something else. So we're going to start with something commemorating our own history, and that is a poem which was written by Pádraig Pearse, P.H. Pearse, Henry MacPearse. And this poem is reputed to be the last poem he wrote before he was executed. And it really captures, to me anyway, how short life is and how unimportant many things that we worry about. And it also shows the courage, I think, that he showed in terms of going to his execution for a cause that he believed in. So now we're going to hear John O'Connor reading The Wayfarer by Pádraig Pearse.
The beauty of the world hath made me sad, this beauty that will pass. Sometimes my heart has shaken with great joy to see a leaping squirrel in a tree, or a red ladybird upon a stalk, or little rabbits in a field at evening lit by a slanting sun. Or some green field where shadows drifted by, some quiet hill where mountainy men had sown and soon would reap, near to the gate of heaven. Or children with bare feet playing upon the sands of some ebbed sea, or playing on the streets of little towns in Connacht. Things young and happy. And then my heart had told me, these will pass and change, will die and be no more. Things bright and green, things young and happy, and I have gone upon my way, sorrowful.
Isn't that lovely? I think that's really very, very deep. Well done, John, well read. So we had, with 100 years since that rebellion took place, and a huge amount has been written on it, but I think that poem really picks up or contrasts a lot of the stuff that went on. Now, during the rebellion that took place in our own country, there was a horrific world war going on in France, mainly France and Belgium and so on, but I was looking for something that would commemorate that, and I came across a poem written by a Canadian man, a doctor, John McCrae. And he was working in Ypres during the Battle of Ypres, and he worked for 17 days on the trot in a nursing station. And after what he had seen and the horrific maiming and so on, it was absolutely dreadful. One of the things that struck me about that, subsequently doing some research on it, 10 million people, soldiers were killed and 20 million wounded, and 20 million subsequently died from the dreadful flu. So it's mind-boggling. But this doctor, after this dreadful experience, sat down and wrote this poem, and it was subsequently came to light when his effects were being gone through, because he himself was killed in 1918 on active duty. So this poem is a short poem. It's going to be read now by Rebecca Blomfield, and it's called In Flanders Fields by Major John McCrae.
In Flanders fields the poppies blow, between the crosses row on row, that mark our place, and in the sky the larks still bravely singing fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved,
and now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarry with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw. The torch be yours to hold it high. If you break with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields.
Yeah, every time I read that, I just think of the absolute stupidity of the, and the waste of people's lives. What was the great BBC take on... I can't think of it at the moment, it's off the top of my head, but it was a satirical look at the First World War.
Dad's Army?
Dad's Adder. And I think that really showed up the absolute stupidity of people talking about it. We had a good night last night, we only lost 20,000 men, you know, this type of thing. Yeah. I can never understand that sort of thinking. Now, another anniversary that we celebrate this year is the 75th anniversary of the death of James Joyce. Now, some people say that he's the best writer in the whole world that ever lived, and some people disagree with that, but you know, many people regard him as a fantastic writer. It's interesting that despite the fact that he lived so many years abroad, so much of his writing refers back to his home place here indeed in Dublin. And he wrote some poems also, but unusually he never agreed to have titles on his poems. So I want you to listen to this one now and see how would you place it. And this is a poem, again, written by Rebecca.
Oh, it was out by Dunnycarney when the bat flew from tree to tree. My love and I did walk together, and sweet were the words she said to me. Along with us the summer wind went murmuring, oh, happily, but softer than the breath of summer was the kiss she gave to me.
All together. So there's a lovely romantic piece that you don't normally associate with James Joyce. But let's dedicate this to all the people out there who were in love. I believe Christmas Eve is the day that most people propose in terms of weddings and so on. So we want to wish all those people well. And all the people in love in this room.
We love you too, Declan.
Yeah, dear. Oh, sure. Right. Okay. Right. Moving on swiftly. They say. Right. Now we're going. Some time ago, a lady was talking to me, and she was giving out socks about the weather. She was giving out about the winter, and the same woman had been giving out to me 2 weeks earlier because it was too warm. So you know these people who complained about seasons and so on, and that can be thinking about, when you know, autumn, winter, New Year's Eve and going into the next season. So I've put together a few bits and pieces here which I hope you will like. And the first one is I think an absolutely beautiful poem, and it's by Keats, and it's called To Autumn, and it's now going to be read, performed or interpreted by Mary McNamara.
Season of mist and mellow fruitfulness, close bosom friend of the maturing sun, conspiring with him how to load and bless with fruit the vines that round the thatched eaves run, to bend with apples and mossed cottage trees, and fill all fruit with ripeness to the core, to swell the gourd and plump the hazel shells with the sweet kernel, to set budding more and still more later flowers for the bees, until they think warm days will never cease, for summer has o'erbrimmed their clammy cells. Who hath not seen thee oft amid thy store? Sometimes whoever seeks abroad may find thee sitting careless on a granary floor, thy hair soft lifted by the winnowing wind, or on a half-reaped furrow sound asleep, drowsed with the fume of poppies, while thy hook spares the next swathe and all its twined flowers. And sometimes, like a gleaner, thou dost keep steady thy laden head across a brook, or by a cider press, with patient look, thou watchest the last oozing, hours by hours. Where are the songs of spring? Aye, where are they? Think not of them. Thou hast thy music too, while barred clouds bloom the soft dying day and touch the stubble panes with rosy hue. Then in a wailful choir the small gnats mourn among the river sallows, borne aloft or sinking as the light wind lives or dies, and full-grown lambs loud bleat from hilly bourn, hedge cricket sings, and now with treble soft the red breast whistles from a garden croft, and gathering swallows twitter in the skies.
Lovely. To Autumn by John Keats. Yeah, I didn't realise that he was actually very young. He wrote that in the beginning of, September 1818. And he wrote that poem. He began in 18, but he finished it a year later in 1919. And he was extraordinarily very young. He was a chemist, an apothecary, by the way, by his background. So it's amazing what you could pick up. So it's a really beautiful, beautiful poem. So my next season was winter, and I was trying to come across, you know, what picks up the nicely, what sort of poem would capture that. And I, every Saturday in the Sunday Independent Review, there's a section of poetry, and I cut out a section every week because I think it's very, very interesting. But lo and behold, what popped up was a poem by Robert Frost. And absolutely, I think it's fantastic. You could spend a couple of hours talking with this poem, I think, but it's about wintertime, but it's called Stopping by Woods on a Winter Evening, and it's going to be read now by Niamh Murphy.
Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near. Between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep.
Lovely. Stopping by Woods in the Snowy Evening by by Robert Frost. I love that line, miles to go before I sleep. Talk about this forever, can't you? Now, that led me on to the change of the year, New Year's Eve and so on. And that, of course, led me to Auld Lang Syne. And I realised I never knew what even the word meant, which means old, long ago. And then I asked a number of people about the poem, and most people just have the chorus of it. So I said, right, why don't we do something different tonight and recite the whole poem, reputed to be written by Robbie Burns. There's a discussion of the piece. Some people say he didn't, some people say he did. For tonight's purpose, we're going to say that he did. Okay. So all our Auld Lang Syne will now be read by Ursula Byrne.
Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind, should old acquaintance be forgot and days of Auld Lang Syne. For Auld Lang Syne, my dear, for Auld Lang Syne, we'll take a cup of kindness yet for Auld Lang Syne. We too have run about the hills and pulled the daisies fine. We've wandered many a weary foot since Auld Lang Syne. We too have paddled in the burn from morning sun till dine. But seas between us broad have roared since Auld Lang Syne. And here's a hand, my trusty friend, and put your hand in mine. We'll take a right good willy wot for Auld Lang Syne. And surely you lift up your glass, for surely I lift mine, and we'll drink a cup of kindness yet
for
Auld Lang Syne.
Now, it's amazing. I never actually read that right through, so that was very nicely done. So speaking of, we had autumn, we had winter, we had New Year's, and that, of course, another thing strung to mind that my wife always used this expression, but it comes from a poem called Ode to the West Wind by Percy Shelley, written in Florence in 1819, and it said, "O wind, if winter comes, can spring be far behind?" So our next contribution is going to be a song, sung by Francis Keogh, with some help from Niamh Murphy, and it'll remind us of the next season. So, and the song is called the rose.
Some say love, it is a river that drowns the tender reed. Some say love, it is a razor that leaves your soul to bleed. Some say love, it is a hunger, an endless aching need. I say love, it is a flower, and you, its only seed.
It's the heart afraid of breaking that never learns to dance. It's the dream afraid of breaking that never takes a chance. It's the one who won't be taken, who cannot seem to give, and the soul afraid of dying that never learns to live. When the night has been too lonely and the road has been too long, and you think that love is only for the lucky and the strong, just remember in the winter, far beneath the bitter snow, lies the seed that with the sun's love in the spring becomes the rose. Lies the seed that with the sun's love in the spring becomes the rose.
Yes, lovely. Well done, Fran and Liam. So, ladies and gentlemen, to the lady out there who was complaining about the weather, it's going to improve. Spring is coming. So we're going to move on now. By the way, we got a message in. Bravo, a wonderful reflective link to Christmas. 10 of us here are sampling the Christmas wine. We raise our glass to you. Oh, Connie, I was just mentioning to the gang here, Connie, that you had a bit of misfortune recently and you're laid up. So it's great to see you're taking your medicine. Yeah. So very good. Now, earlier on, we're nearly coming to the end of the programme now, so we're moving on. So I mentioned a while ago about people losing their homes, but on this particular one we're going to something positive where people are getting new homes. And there's a particular couple that some of us here would know, Fran, John and Ursula would know. Bernie Owens and her husband Keith have got a new house and they're moving in very, very shortly. So Bernie and Keith, and to all those people who are lucky enough, and to all those people who have homes, this is a blessing, which is written by John O'Donoghue, that wonderful writer who died so young, and great Celtic spirituality expert. And it's called A New Home Blessing, which is now going to be read by Maura Walsh.
May this house shelter your life when you come in home here. May all the weight of the world fall from your shoulders. May your heart be tranquil here, blessed by peace the world cannot give. May this home be a lucky place where the graces of your desires always find the pathway to your door. May nothing destructive ever cross your threshold. May this be a safe place, full of understanding and acceptance, where you can be as you are, without the need of any mask or pretense or image. May this home be a place of discovery, where the possibilities that sleep in the clay of your soul can emerge to deepen and refine your vision for all that is yet to come to birth. May it be a house of courage, where healing and growth are loved, where dignity and forgiveness prevail. A home where patience of spirit is prized, and the sight of the destinations is never lost, though the journey be difficult and slow. May there be great delight around this hearth.
Isn't that lovely?
Lovely.
It's a great, well done, Martha. It was lovely, lovely interpretation of that. So again, watching the clock, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to finish off now with two poems. One, Ascoelga, Banachtí and another, written by Liam O'Mirrithala, and the English translation called Christmas Greetings, translated by Kieran Carson. And both are going to be performed now by our own infamous, famous Peter Pryor, a raglig, a feather.
I'll start with the English version, okay. Which is by Kieran Carson on Christmas Greetings. The clean dawn air above the city is inhaled in barrelfuls to swell the muscles. Birds sing the Montanotti aria as I sneak with my bags past the high terraced houses. My heart leaps as I reach the bakery and she offers me her Christmas greetings with my bag of bread. Leaving home on Christmas Eve, my hand steals into the warmth of the baps beside me on the seat. A shudder goes through the train as it leans into the tunnel's mouth. At least the belly will be full. So that's the English, and now Ascoelga Banachtí na nollag. Eir chil na modhanna os cion na chachrach, orith is a limfa barilla ag bolgu na mothán. Na hain ag canu aria Montanotti is me ag gawal the chushkeim eiliach lem wali har an ardhán. Thuggan mokri leim ag an marcus is gwein si Banachtí na nollag orim lem wala arain. Ihe nollag ag fagan chan walia Sheena Malov im Rohul Namwilini, Tevlom Aran Siakon. Shain Aring Thrin Thrain Ag Taranch Gogir Ar Vale and Tholoin, Ar Eliath Bayan Bullock Lawn.
Alvar Father, going to Kafada Father. That was lovely. Thank you very much, Peter. Ladies and gentlemen, that comes to the end of our programme. But I just want to say thank you very much to all those who contributed to this programme, who read, sang, or performed. We got Maura Walsh, we got Carol Dempsey, we got Mary McNamara, Peter Pryor, we got Francis Keogh, we got Ursula Byrne, we got Niamh Murphy, Michael Sharp, we've got Mia Shalander, Declan Murphy, John O'Connor, Joe Murphy, and Rebecca Blomfield, and George and Rebecca in the control room. Thank you very, very much indeed. I want to thank all our listeners. I said Deborah, didn't
you?
No. I beg your pardon. Sorry, Deborah. Imagine forgetting. Oh, I'd be in trouble. So, thank you to our listeners to have listened in. I have a message here. Well done, guys. A big shout out to my mammy Ursula, Jerry, and Daniel from Artane. How about that? So on behalf of all of us here in the Drama Company, may I wish you happiness in your home and particularly in your heart. And remember, I heard something on the radio recently about happiness. You know, this thing that people chase around and they hope to try to get it by buying things. But It says, happiness can be achieved by doing the best you can at what you're best at for the benefit of others. So do the best you can at what you're best at for the benefit of others. And that goes right back to Aristotle 2,500 years ago. So, ladies and gentlemen, that's the end of our programme. So, till we meet again, farewell until you hear our signature tune, Curtain Up.